From Michigan Radio, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, disapproval rates top 60% for both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Daniel Howes wonders, is this the best we can do?
I don't think any time in my lifetime have both major parties at the same time in the same cycle have nominated such deeply flawed candidates.
Using the power of street art to transform struggling neighborhoods.
Street art is ever-changing, should be allowed, especially in communities that want to see that over blight.
And Oakland County endurance athletes going after a Guinness World Record with a 65-mile swim.
Once your brain gets into its alpha wave thinking, you really zone out, and your mind shuts down, and your body is going through the motions, but you're not having to be consciously aware of it.
Those stories and more, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Living the video game dream in Lansing and transforming urban blight into urban art. That's coming up later in the program. But first, it's Thursday, time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, with us now via Skype. But let's start this with this morning's big news from General Motors, that second quarter report.
Smoking, absolutely smoking. General Motors continues to be on a roll and trying, I think, to convince the skeptical investment community that this is for real, that they are an earnings machine. CEO Mary Barr at the end of the call this morning reiterated in saying, this shows that we are an earnings machine or an earnings engine and that we are a compelling investment opportunity. And if that wasn't a sales job, I don't know what was.
And to that point, tell everyone, how much did General Motors make in its second quarter?
Almost $2.9 billion, which was up 157% from last year's $1.1 billion. They continue to really light it up, particularly in North America. That's what's really driving these earnings, not China, certainly not South America, which continues to be problematic, and not Europe, which is starting to get in the black for the first time in about 5 years, actually. I think they did their first profitable quarter since sometime in 2011. I've been covering that story for going back almost 20 years, including living in Germany for 4 years. And Europe has been a problem for a very long time, but yeah, it looks like they're finally getting some traction.
Now, with this in mind, this record $2.87 billion second quarter earnings. So here we have the fact that earlier this month, the Federal Appeals Court in Manhattan ruled that the GM bankruptcy does not protect the automaker from those lawsuits over the ignition switch defect. And we've got lawyers during that hearing talking about $10 billion in claims. And now the appeals court has stripped away that argument of GM, hey, we went bankrupt. And GM's creditors got their own win in a Manhattan court with the bankruptcy judge there giving them the green light to go after old GM to the tune of $1.5 billion. So how does this all fit in with this record-setting second quarter?
Well, they're clearly offsets. But, you know, these things have to be adjudicated. I mean, it's not just because they get the green light to go ahead and do it doesn't mean that these lawsuits or all of them are going to be successful. But clearly, it's going to be money, distraction, issues they're going to have to deal with, but they have to get through them. I don't think anybody thinks that plaintiff's lawyers are going to, now that they've been given a green light by a federal court, that they're going to say, you know what, we're not going to pursue it. I mean, that ain't going to happen. So they're just going to have to, they're going to have to continue to work their way through this. I mean, I think this is part of a much broader mosaic in the industry, which is that the modern contemporary American legal system and regulatory system is going to hold manufacturers accountable one way or another. I mean, you see this happening with Volkswagen and their whole Dieselgate. It's going to continue to be an issue, and I'm not surprised, and frankly, they're just going to have to get their way through it.
I want to turn over to politics. Your column from yesterday, is this the best the country can do for president? Let's get into your thoughts as you've watched the Republicans convening this week. And then, of course, we know the Democrats will convene next week in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. What got you to write that column?
Disgust. You know, I look at both of these major candidates. I don't think any time in my lifetime have both major parties at the same time in the same cycle have nominated such deeply flawed candidates as the Republicans and the Democrats have. The choices, I think, are frankly pretty scary. One has national security implications and a very difficult issue with the truth. The other has difficult issues with the truth and is a pretty towering narcissist. I mean, I think we're in a very difficult situation. I talk to friends, other people about this, and a lot of people are not happy. On the other hand, I think you have people that respond to a column like that, and they're so blinded by their support of one candidate or the other, that no matter what these candidates do or don't do, they can't step back and say, you know, something here isn't right. Mm-hmm. But it's what we got, and we're going to have to work our way through it.
Well, it's amazing. This morning I jumped on Huffington Post pollster just to see what are the latest mm-hmm. numbers. And Hillary Clinton's unfavorable rating is 56% today, favorable just a little over 39%. And you consider that in May 2011, her favorability rating was over 60%. It's basically flip-flopped. And Donald Trump right now has an unfavorable rating of over 60%. Is there anything these two candidates you think can do to improve these dismal opinions before Election Day?
Well, Trump has a golden opportunity tonight. I mean, how many times have we heard him in the primaries? You want me to be presidential? I can be presidential. Well, you know what? You can't just say it. You got to be it. I mean, anybody who knows human nature knows that somebody that's 70 years old doesn't easily change their basic human nature very easily. But he has a real opportunity tonight to make a statement and to appear presidential. Apparently, he's working with some Reagan-era speechwriters, including the one who helped President Reagan write the Tear Down This Wall speech in Berlin, and I believe it was 1988. But that's just one thing. In terms of Hillary Clinton, I mean, you know, she's going to continue to be dogged, I think, by FBI Director Comey's assessment of what she did or didn't do in the email scandal. My concern in that whole thing, and I think a lot of people who think more deeply about this, is not just that she set up the servers, but those servers were likely hacked by foreign governments, adversaries to the United States, and potentially some of her aides were also hacked. And I think the FBI feels that pretty clearly from what they've said. So then the question you have to ask yourself is, what do these foreign governments have on somebody who could be president of the United States? That's not an answer we're going to know as the average voter. I can bet that the FBI's counterintelligence arm is trying to figure it out. But we're not going to know. And I find that very concerning.
And just to wrap up, I want to give you a chance to serve up the same quote you ended your column with, the H.L. Mencken quote.
H.L. Mencken was a famous journalist from Baltimore, and he wrote this. He said, "Democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it good and hard."
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In hot, dry summers like we're having this year, mosquitoes are fewer but potentially more dangerous. That's because West Nile virus spreads more easily in warm weather. Michigan State University predicts a West Nile outbreak this summer. WMUK's Rebecca Thiel reports.
Ken Werfel and his pest control team at Mosquito Squad spray an insecticide on a yard on the east side of Kalamazoo. He says despite some drought this summer, business has been good. We had a lot of rain this spring.
And so when we're wet, we're successful. And we've had a great wet spring, and that's all we need. If there's ponding rains in April and May, then we're going to have a great year. If there isn't, if it's dry, April, May, even June, then our business suffers.
Werfel says he doesn't get as many calls when it's a hot, dry summer like this one. There just aren't as many mosquitoes out there. But while some species of mosquitoes suffer in the heat, the one that carries West Nile virus thrives. It's a hardy little mosquito called Culex pipiens, and it likes urban areas with standing water. Werfel says they breed in everything from large retention ponds to the smallest pooling water you can find.
If you have a water bottle and you take the cap and give it a toss and it happens to land cup side up, that little bottle cap, a mosquito could, if it filled with water, lay a raft of 300 eggs. Just that little bottle cap.
However, it's not just the army of Culex mosquitoes that makes summers like this bad for West Nile. Ned Walker researches mosquito-borne diseases at Michigan State University. He says the hot weather also helps the virus to spread.
You know, mosquitoes are animals, they're cold-blooded, and so the warmer it is, the faster things happen. And mosquitoes get the virus infection by feeding on infected birds. And then once a mosquito's gotten a blood meal from an infected bird, the virus has to grow inside the body of the mosquito. And it grows faster when it's warmer.
Every year, Walker's team at MSU tries to predict West Nile outbreaks based on weather patterns. He says this season closely resembles the summer of 2012. That year, we saw the most recorded deaths from West Nile in U.S. history. Out of more than 5,000 cases, roughly 280 people died. Because the Culex mosquito likes urban areas, you're safer in the woods than you are in the city. In fact, Walker says most people probably get West Nile in their own homes. He nicknames Culex pipiens the northern house mosquito because it sneaks into houses through open doors and windows.
Or perhaps the screens are not repaired properly and there are holes in screens. Things like that that allow those mosquitoes to actually come indoors.
Walker says they also bite very late at night.
And so that's not the typical time that people put on repellent. For example, I don't know anybody who puts on mosquito repellent right before they go to bed.
So how do you fight such a stealthy, tough mosquito? Walker says the best way is through community-wide control.
You can't dump out an abandoned swimming pool, and you can't empty out thousands of street catch basins. But you can treat them. And there are communities that have adopted programs like this.
According to the Michigan Mosquito Control Association, only 4 counties and about 10 townships have treatment programs. Tom Putt of the association says there used to be a lot more 10 years ago, but cities and towns don't have the money for that anymore. Ned Walker says the few municipalities that have mosquito programs are often the only ones that send MSU mosquitoes for testing. Walker says even high-risk areas like Grand Rapids and Detroit don't report.
Unfortunately, without good surveillance, we can't make strong statements about the risk. But we do have this forecast model based on weather, and that's been quite reliable so far.
Back in Kalamazoo, Ken Werfel of the Mosquito Squad says there are some things you can do to keep Culex mosquitoes from breeding.
Tip over standing water containers, toss out any unwanted leaves or clippings or mulch piles or trash in the yard, because anything that can be a container for water can be a container for mosquito eggs.
Fortunately, according to the Centers for Disease Control, 70 to 80% of people who contract the virus don't have any symptoms. I'm Rebecca Thiel.
How do you prepare to swim 40 straight hours? That's coming up. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty, and you are listening to Stateside. Next time you take a swim, think of doing that for 65 miles, of plowing through that water for nearly 40 hours. And that's what it'll be like to be Adam Ellenstein next Monday and Tuesday. Adam is an ultra-distance triathlete from Oakland County. He's going for the Guinness World Record for fastest north-to-south nonstop swim of Okanagan Lake in British Columbia. It's Victory Swim 105. Adam Ellenstein, welcome.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks so much for having me today.
And I know you did an 18-mile swim across Lake Winnipeg as part of your training, but this is a beaut, 105 kilometers and 65 miles, and you want to do it in how much time?
Hopefully between 35 and 40 hours. If we finish under 40 hours, we'll finish before the sun goes down on day two, so that's our hope. We can get great photographs as the sun's going down and start the celebration.
Okay. I've never had a chance to talk to someone who does these kind of extreme events. I know you are an Ultraman triathlon, 320 miles. What is going on in your brain while you're doing that? How do you keep yourself focused for that period of time, or do you?
Yeah, well, over the course of a marathon swim, your perspective changes quite a bit. So you have highs and you have lows. Sometimes it's best to lose yourself, to kind of shut down your mind and shut down your body and live in the empty spaces between your thoughts. And at other times, it's necessary to be completely engaged with the crew, focused on nutrition, focused on comfort, focused on having fun. And so it really varies. For the most part, you are in your own head. You can sing songs to yourself. You can think about things that you haven't thought about for a while, and try to get into a zone. We hear a lot of athletes talk about the zone, getting into the zone, and for ultra distance athletes, for swimmers especially, that's where we want to get to, because hours can go by and they feel like minutes. And that's when you're trying to swim 65 miles nonstop. You hope for a few of those over the course of the lake.
Let's talk about what's going on in your body. Let's talk about, are you eating, drinking? You talked about nutrition. How is that happening while you're swimming?
Yeah, so my regimen is that I'll stop about every 30 minutes and take some calories in. My goal will be to consume about 250 to 300 calories an hour. So over the course of the 40 hours, I'll be taking in anywhere between 10 and 12,000 calories. Mostly they're simple sugars. So a lot of it'll be liquid hydration, so Gatorade type things. I have a liquid nutrition called Hammer Perpetuum, which is a sponsored company of mine that I've had great success with. Last year's swim across Lake Winnipeg went really, really well. And I was exclusively on liquid nutrition for that. So that gave me the confidence to jump up to 65 miles. So every 30 minutes I'll stop. Others stop every hour.
And you're allowed to do that and
yep,
go
absolutely.
For the world record.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can stop as much as I want in the water. I won't get out of the water and I won't touch any of the boats. So nutrition will be passed to me from kayakers who will be alongside me. And that's the goal. That's the hope. That's the dream. So,
and that's what gets you the record. So no touching boats.
Yeah.
No sleeping.
No sleeping.
No sleeping.
No. Unless I can sleep swim, which I'm hoping I can do. We're actually really looking forward to...
Is that a thing? Stop. Is that really a thing?
Well, no. you can be in a zone again. You can really... once your brain gets into its alpha wave thinking, you really zone out. And your mind shuts down and your body is going through the motions, but you're not having to be consciously aware of it. And so that's where we want to get to. And it's really, really special when you get there. Nighttime, we're really looking forward to swimming at night. It'll be easier because there will be less to look at. There will be less visual distractions. So one of the things that can happen is that you're distracted by things around you, other boaters, the beautiful sunset, all of those things kind of bring you back to the present. And for zonal swimmers, for alpha wave swimmers, we want to get out of that. And so nighttime is really, really special time.
We have to have you talk about your reason for doing this. It's a very personal thing, and it's Parkinson's disease.
Absolutely. So in the fall of 2015, my Aunt Susan was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And as she learned more about that diagnosis, she discovered the impact that exercise can have on managing the disease. And so she and I put our heads together, and that's how Victory Swim 105 was born. So it's a swim to encourage others with Parkinson's to take up the challenge of exercise in order to live with their disease in a more healthy way and to enjoy every day for what it is.
And your aunt's going to be swimming with you for Parkinson's?
She is. She lives in Texas. She's been training for the past 5 or 6 months enthusiastically, calls me every week excited about the new benchmarks that she's been reaching. Last week, she swam 100 laps in her local pool nonstop. She had only planned to do 50, and so she said about lap 45, she kind of settled in. She got into that zone. And before she knew it, she was at 75 or 80 and saw that 100-mile mark or 100-lap mark and just said, I'm going for it.
That's impressive. And she's putting me to shame. I'm going to tell you that right now. What's the first meal that you think you're going to want when you get out of the water after all those hours?
I'm a big fan of pizza. I'll probably be eating some pizza along the way. If liquid nutrition, if sugary things start to feel like they're upsetting my stomach, I'll switch over to crunchy things and salty things. And so pizza is one of the things that I really enjoy. If I don't eat pizza during the swim, I'm definitely going to have it on the beach in Penticton. It's one of my favorites, and it's what I'll look forward to.
So I know that you're inviting everybody to kind of join you in a sense and also work with the Davis Finney Foundation to help Parkinson's.
That's right. Our hope is to raise awareness and support for those with Parkinson's through our partnership with the Davis Finney Foundation. They're a group that is worldwide, and they hold victory summits all over the world. Our victory crew is going to be one of their victory summits, and so we encourage everybody who's interested to get on our Facebook page, Victory Swim 105, to join our group to support the Davis Finney Foundation for Parkinson's. And that's really the motivation for our swim.
And to send pictures of themselves swimming along to keep you going in the water.
Absolutely.
Well, it is a long way from Oakland County to Okanagan Lake in British Columbia. We wish you a lot of luck on this 65-mile or 105-kilometer swim. Good luck to you.
Thanks so much, Cindy. We appreciate it.
Collaborative, part of the community.
The next idea.
You need to be awake and take actions to make sure the things that matter to you and the impacts that you want to see in the world actually happen. And I feel like a lot of people don't do that.
Take an abandoned, unloved alley. Clear away the trash and debris. And then turn artists loose with their paint and brushes to transform those alleys and, in turn, the neighborhood. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea did exactly that. Michigan-born artist Jason Ostro used art to clean up the area around his L.A. art gallery, the GABA Gallery. It's the GABA Alley Project L.A., 4 decaying alleys that have been transformed into works of art. And now he's launched the GABA Alley Project Detroit, recently painting his first mural in Detroit's Midtown. Jason Ostro, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
I love the way you describe the idea on your website, from blight to bright. Where'd you get this idea?
You know what? I was walking around my neighborhood and I was seeing a lot of graffiti and a lot of garbage and a lot of pieces from drug users and everything. I mean, we have a very large homeless problem in Los Angeles. So anywhere that you could hide as a human being in an alley or anywhere else, it's pretty much where you would hide and try to find your safety. Well, the alleys around my gallery got so congested with garbage and people living there that the neighbors were afraid to come out. And it was completely just decimated, strewn mattresses and couches and dressers and TVs and garbage everywhere. I mean, anybody who was moving out stuff from their house would throw it in alleys. Mm. And then you would see these encampments of people. And the first alley that we started, there was probably like 20, 25 people living in the alley that we had to go. And we talked to them a little bit and tried to say, hey, you know, there's these shelters we can help you get to. There's programs in Los Angeles. Well, a lot of them didn't really want our help and just kind of left on their own regards.
Your idea was just that you as a someone who was a business owner and then thinking of the people in the neighborhood deserve better.
Let's clean up. Let's get our neighborhood together so we can walk around anywhere and feel safe. So I was noticing a lot of blight. And being that I'm really into art and being that I really, really love street art and the creativity and the imagination and what can be done on these huge, huge canvases of walls, I just wanted to do something in my neighborhood. So we put a mural together, and it got a great response from the neighborhood. And then as soon as we put our first mural up, we had a developer in the neighborhood say, you know, we'll help you with a small donation. And as soon as that happened, we jumped and we cleaned out the alley. We got 24 artists to come out. We painted the alley and
now it's grown. You have four alleys. How many murals?
There's over 113 murals now by like 83, 84 artists.
And these are artists not just local. You have people come from all over the world.
Oh, yes. We have people everywhere.
How'd that word spread? Just through the art community or buzz? Or did you actually invite people?
I started by inviting people, actually. And from there, I found a couple really incredible artists and invited them to come and basically play with us. And I said, yeah, listen, we can supply the paint. We have a grant to basically supply your paint, but unfortunately, we can't really supply anything else. But this is a community beautification project. We're turning blight to bright, which is basically the first time I said it. And at that point, there was a resonance that basically stuck with me on that. Mm. And I thought to myself, you know, this is the perfect call line for what we're doing here, because I'm not trying to change neighborhoods in the sense that I want to push out anybody. I want to change neighborhoods to make the people that live there comfortable so they can walk into their alleys, they can walk around their neighborhood, and they don't have to feel threatened.
And you begin by getting permission, don't you?
Oh, yes. It's if you don't get permission, you can get into a lot of trouble. So there's a lot of different methods. My method is door-to-door. Knock, knock, knock. Hi, my name is Jason Ostro. I own the GABA Gallery around the corner. We're trying to really change the neighborhood in the sense of making it safer for everybody and taking away a lot of the gang graffiti and the trash and, you know, all the refuse. And when we first began, there was, in our first alley, I would probably say 16 out of the 24 spots were like, yeah, go ahead. This is fantastic. We'd love to have you there. And as we continued that first weekend, people were coming out of their house and they were saying, oh, my God, this is amazing. Could you do mine too? And it was, it just landslid. It just like everybody, and then the whole block was done.
I'm talking with Michigan-born artist Jason Ostro about the work he's done transforming alleys around his Los Angeles art gallery, the GABA Gallery. And now he's hoping to bring this effort to the Detroit area. And you actually did just complete a mural in Detroit. What needed to come together for you to be able to do that?
I think it's a matter of just working really, really hard and pushing. Eventually, I got tied into One Time Run and Interstate Gallery, and they're fantastic over there. They're really, really sweet and really nice people. And we were talking about projects, and I was telling them about my project in L.A. and explaining that I was also an artist. And I had mentioned that I really loved one of the pieces that had just gone up on one of their walls from an artist that I'm actually doing a solo show with next year. And they said, oh, there's an extra wall on that building. Do you want that? And they said, yeah,
yes.
I do. I sure do. So I did it at 2nd Avenue and Martin Luther King. And it was a really nice, fun experience. And I was getting a lot of people saying, be careful in Cass Corridor, be careful in Cass Corridor. Mm-hmm. And I grew up here. I definitely understand, be careful in Cass Corridor. But the people were fantastic. I mean, the super sweet, super nice, super appreciative people coming up out of nowhere going, God, I love this. I love the art that's going on in the neighborhood. Those are the things that, you know, make these projects push and make you want to keep on doing more and more and more.
The effect of the street art. What does it say to us about what street art can mean to a community?
Well, street art can change a community in the sense of making you feel happy and making you feel like you want to be in your neighborhood. You walk down the street, you see trash on the walls, you see graffiti on the walls, you see the graffiti crossed out, and then there's something else on the wall with another graffiti tag. I mean, it's kind of the system of tagging. It's like one piece goes up, something gets tagged, crossed off, another piece goes up, and then eventually it's blight. It doesn't look good. You know, there's all these incredible artists that they put up a mural and the neighbors come out and they say, God, I love this. It makes me happy.
We had internationally renowned street artist Shepard Fairey in Detroit in May of 2015 to do a commission work. And then he pasted 7 works around the city, and the city smacked him with felony charges. Although a Wayne County judge recently dismissed the charges, the city says it plans to appeal. So here we are, street art versus graffiti. Where do you see that line, and what are your thoughts in the art community over that whole drama?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at street art. Graffiti is a part of street art. Murals are a part of street art. You have this large divide with some people who think that one thing shouldn't exist while the other thing should exist. Maybe some street taggers don't want to see the street murals because they don't believe that it should go up there. Meanwhile, the muralists don't want to see the tagging because they want to have that spot to put up a really beautiful piece. As far as it goes with Shepard, him coming back here, and I believe it was Gilbert who hired them to do that huge mural.
Gilbert. Yes.
You know, he did the mural. He comes back here. He's putting up other pieces around in the city. You know, if he knocked on doors, those people probably would have said, sure, we'd love to have you do it.
What you're doing in L.A., knocking on a door.
Yeah. But if like any of Shep's people had knocked on doors and said, hey, we want to do this here, it would have been great. But Shep didn't get a start that way. Shep got a start from doing these pieces and these wheat pastes all around. But when these pieces go up, they're almost landmarks for people to go and see and go and check out. So the whole idea that he destroyed and malicious destruction of these 7 or 8 properties or whatever that he did, and it was a $30,000 damage report, blah, 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 blah. If these people actually thought about utilizing that art, they would have made so much more money than the $30,000 that they said it cost to repair it. And the fact that the DA here in Michigan is going back after them and appealing the case, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's street art is ever-changing, should be allowed, especially in communities that want to see that over blight. It makes sense to me. I know it doesn't make sense to everybody, and I don't expect it to make sense to everybody because art is very much in everybody's own ideals. Like, I could like something.
Tremendously subjective.
Yeah. So while I love something, somebody could come down the street and say, oh, God, why is that here?
And if I live along those alleys, at least I have something bright and good to look at. And you're hearing that from residents that say they're glad you did this.
Oh, in one of the news stories that was written out, one of the people said, you know, this is so wonderful that he was an artist himself. He's a musician. He said, when I ever get stumped and I can't write anything, I just walk up and down the alley and I get all my inspiration from the alley.
You can find lots of photos of the murals we've been talking about on Jason's website, GABAGallery.com. That's G-A-B-B-A, GABAGallery.com. Or just go to the Next Idea page at MichiganRadio.org. Jason Ostro, it was great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you so much. And listen, just one more thing. On the website and the Alley Project page, there's a donate button. If you want to help us, please, please donate, because everything's done with community support. And we really, really would love to color the world.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This Saturday marks the 49th anniversary of the civil unrest in Detroit, sparked by a police raid. It became one of the most violent urban revolts of 20th century America, leaving 43 people dead, hundreds injured, some $32 million in property damage. That's why the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit chose this Saturday to unveil United We Stand, a 25-foot landmark sculpture by Charles McGee, who is a Kresge Foundation eminent artist. Charles McGee believes its theme of unity is crucial because our nation seems more divided than ever.
We see racial strife. We see all kinds of differences. Instead of utilizing the differences in a way that nature intended as one form, we use it for self-adulation, self-aggrandizement for self. And that bothers me, and it's been my intentions throughout my 91 years on the planet to express this basic thought, as it's been revealed to me from living these 91 years.
United We Stand will be unveiled at 3:30 this Saturday at the Wright Museum, followed by a celebration with entertainment and activities. Coming up, a Lansing software developer's living the dream of creating a video game in our state. And then in 15 minutes, a book review of Seasonal Roads by L.E. Kimball, part of our series, Michigan Bookmark. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A Lansing-based video game company is putting the final touches on a video game that got a big helping hand from an MSU computer science expert. The game is called Tuebor, which means I will defend in Latin. Scott Reschke has been laboring over this game for a lot of years, so it's a big moment for him to see this work come to fruition. Scott Reschke is the CEO of Strength in Numbers Studios in Lansing. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with the name of this game. We say Tuebor, T-U-E-B-O-R, which features a nod to the state of Michigan. In what way?
It's on the seal of the state of Michigan. It actually, that was where I found it. I was with my little girl at the Capitol building, and we were just walking around, and the game was originally named Rise or Fall Legends. And, you know, it's kind of hokey. It's kind of cheesy, gamey sound, and I never really liked it, but I didn't have anything better. And we were just checking out the Capitol building, and I saw the seal. It's on all the windows everywhere, and it's right in front of me. And I was like, I wonder what that means. And so I popped out the smartphone and looked it up, and I was like, I will defend. Wow, that's really cool. That's going to work really well for the game because the game is a lot of cooperative action. There's stuff player versus player where you're defending bases. There's players working together to defend facilities. And so the whole sense of it worked nicely together. And given that we're in the state of Michigan and through this whole process of raising money and opening the company, everybody said, you need to leave. You got to go out west. You got to go to Boston. You got to go to New York. You got to go to Chicago. You got to go to L.A. or Seattle or San Francisco. And so I thought, you know what? I'm staying here. So the I will defend isn't just about the game. It's about the whole sense of we have to stop the brain drain, the talent drain of the state. And so it all rolled together. Yeah.
A lot of levels to that. And you also have another hint of the Michigan roots. I see there's a level called New Detroit.
Yeah. So the story takes place in the year 7235 Common Era. Thousands of years have passed. There's been warfare. There's been, disease and famine and then the rebuilding of society time and time again. But through it all, kind of the spirit of Detroit, not just the statue, but the whole spirit of Detroit is about persevering. It's about surviving. It's about rebuilding. It's about being something more than just a place. And so New Detroit is a city that was ripped from the ground and it floats in the sky using science-y term of zero-point energy, where it just kind of hovers in the sky. And that's where all of the technology comes from in the game. So New Detroit itself is featured as a level in the game where the players get to run around. It's kind of a capture the flag one. But we took the spirit of Detroit and the statue and then the fist, and we turn them into holograms that you can run around through and in and see. And, you know, we really wanted to pay an homage to the city and the state because of, you know, this is where we're making our stand.
Rising from the ashes. Where did this idea come from? Because you really have been laboring this for quite a long time.
A long time, longer than I would have liked. But, it's all coming together now. I owned a cyber cafe in East Lansing for about eight and a half years. And at the cyber cafe, we had systems set up, about 60 computers, and people would come in, pay by the hour to play video games there. And it was really great. It was a wonderful social experiment because you had a lot of teenagers and 20-somethings who didn't either couldn't go to the bar or didn't want to, or, you know, their favorite hobby was video games. And so they would come there, and it was a wonderful experience because you'd see a lot of people who had never, ever met each other before, and they would just start talking to other people with these common interests, and they'd sit and they'd play, and then 2 weeks later, they're best friends and they're scheduling time. Well, over those years, I'd been keeping track of why do people play these games, and why do they leave their favorite game to go play a new one, and, you know, what are those things that they really hate and really love, and I had the games installed on the computers that people wanted to come in to pay to play. And then I realized over a few years, I was like, wow, I've got kind of a blueprint for a game. I know the things that are keeping them playing and then the things that drive them away. And so the whole concept behind this game is what's called end game content, meaning you don't necessarily have to spend 2 months to try and get to the best stuff, which is a lot of the case in many games, is you have to spend a lot of time before
you earn your way to
exactly.
It.
And for this, one of the things that we found that the gamers really loved is that endgame content. And so we thought, all right, we'll just chuck away all the rest, and we'll just make all these different game modes where it would be as if you had spent those couple months leveling and earning that thing, but just giving it to you all up front. And so it's what's called cross-genre. You've got some elements from MMORPGs. You've got some elements from what are called MOBAs, battle arenas. You've got some RTS elements. You've got some first-person shooter elements. And we've blended it and we've tested it, and it's coming together really well. In theory, this game is something that anyone that has ever played a video game before should be able to easily jump in and understand. We're calling it an MMO Lite.
MMO Lite. And you have worked with actually someone who has been here on Stateside, Michigan State University Professor Aaron Hintz, working on artificial intelligence. So tell me, what has he helped you build into this game that sets it apart?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, the way everything kind of flows together, I'd spent a lot of years networking, and I met him through his boss and through these different people. And it was just, at first, I was just talking to him to see if he would help me develop the game. I didn't have any idea of what he had done or who he was or anything like that. As far as I knew, he was just but he was just a game developer that was teaching at MSU. Well, turns out he was quite a bit more than that. He was a computer science professor, associate professor, and he had been building, along with his boss, a artificial intelligence system that followed evolutionary design, or the kind of the concepts behind that, to where it learns through generations, and the things that survive get to move to the next generation. Now, I'm sure I'm going to butcher this a little bit, but he's told me, you know, we've gone over it so many times, I feel like I've got a pretty decent grasp on it. So what this code is designed to do, it's really cool. It is, you set the intelligence and you give it these basic set of instructions of you can move forward, you can turn, you can attack, you can do these core things, right? But we don't tell it move forward. We don't tell it attack. We just let it cycle through all these things. And then what we keep track of is they're called a fitness function. So we run a generation for, say, 10 minutes, and we see, did it do what we want? Meaning, did it get closer to the objective? Did it attack the other player? Did it attack the bad guy? And the ones that actually did the thing that we wanted, we take those genomes and we move it to the next generation. And so then you just keep doing that generation after generation until you actually have it where the machine has learned how to do the thing that you want. Very similar to evolution, where, you know, I asked him at one point to explain, how do we have flight? That makes no sense to me. How did something, it didn't just jump out of a tree and get feathers, you know? And he says, well, Scott, we believe it was where these very small life forms had these very fine hairs. And when they would jump, the ones that had the very fine hairs, little gust of wind maybe had pushed them further out of the reach of the predator trying to eat them. And so then the next generation from that had a few more fine hairs, and then the next and the next, and then those hairs sprouted more hairs, and then it turns, you know, over millions of years you have feathers. And I was like, wow, that just blows my mind. And he says, so that's what we're trying to do with this artificial intelligence. I was in luck. He was very eager. He's a game developer. He loves doing that on the side, and he loved the idea of plopping this in so that way we could actually take their software and give it a practical application. And for us, typically in video games, what artificial intelligence does is they're called branch trees. And you say, all right, computer, you have these choices, and you need to do them in this order, and you kind of check it all the time to see if it's something you should do.
Okay.
And the problem with that is it's very limited in terms of it only can do what you've told it to do.
So it gets predictable.
Yeah, very predictable. And what we're trying to accomplish with this is make NPCs, non-player characters, the bad guys, or sometimes good guys if they're helping you, be able to learn over time through the players playing against them smarter behaviors and patterns to make a more dynamic game. Ideally, if we can prove this technology, we could, you know, license it to other game companies so that everybody can have this wonderful learning artificial intelligence.
Very fun. You know, the independent video game world, Scott, it's tough to break into. I don't need to tell you that. So competitive. And even with video games being as big as they are, why is it so challenging to secure funding?
Oh, golly. I have sung that song for a long time. So I started really trying to do this. I had closed my cyber cafe 2008, 2009. The recession just was murderous. I ended up spending about 2 years being a stay-at-home dad, finishing up my bachelor's degree, which I didn't think I was ever going to need. And, you know, life is funny that way. Over the time, I then started developing the product plan and putting down a business plan, and then I started trying to raise the money. Wow, was that difficult. Now, you hear all the time, Michigan has all these incentives, and you read in the news, and I'm sure, you know, there's been an endless amount of radio play about all the investment money that's been in the state in the last few years. And it's true. As long as you are in very certain fields, investors and angel investment groups, I've come to discover, unsurprisingly, invest in industries that they typically had participated in their careers at some point. And so there is a ton of automotive investment in this state. There's a ton of energy investment in this state. There's a ton of healthcare investment in this state. I went to all these different investment pitches and growth capital symposiums and all the angel investment groups. And
presented they have, that idea.
Yeah, and everybody was like, man, you've got this great business plan. You've got a good marketing plan. You've got a good this, this, and this. You know, you really know your product. Sorry, we don't invest in software, and sorry, we don't invest in video games. And the answer was, we just don't understand the industry, and so we don't take that risk.
And good luck to you.
And good luck. And, you know, and that was, again, a lot of times people said, that's why you've got to go out west, because
they get it.
They get software out there. Ann Arbor is a wonderful place for software. You've got a lot of app startups going on around here. Grand Rapids has been a wonderful place for app startups and software, but very more like software light. And it was just a challenging time. Pitching, you know, year after year. And then finally, I had borrowed some money from a family member, and I had basically burned through all of it over the course of about 14, 15 months. And I had $300 left in my bank account. Rent is coming up in 2 weeks, and car payment.
The
and
wolves
my
are
daughter,
at the
you know,
door.
you, when you're my age and you've got a kid, you've got to be a responsible adult.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, this is it. I tried. I really put myself out there, and it didn't work out. So I get a phone call from an investor. And it's somebody that told me no for years. He says, hey, Scott, what are you doing? And I said, well, I've got my resume up. He says, all right, things didn't go well. I said, well, $300 in the account, and it didn't work. He says, how much do you need? And I said, well, I need at least this amount. And he goes, all right, I'm in. And I'm just like, but you've told me no for years.
This is like an episode of Shark Tank.
Yeah. And he says, well, you know, we've talked about it a lot. It sounds like you know what you're doing and how to do it and how we can accomplish this. And he says, let's do this.
So suddenly you could delete that resume.
2 weeks later, I've got the studio opened up and I've started hiring people. And we ended up having at our peak about 33 people that were either local or contracted. The bulk of people were in Lansing. Then we just started hammering away at it and start building the product.
And you did get some money, a couple hundred thousand, from the Michigan Film and Digital Media Office before they've pulled the funding.
Yep, that one was, I'd been trying for years during the networking to get in and discover what I needed to do. And originally, the incentive, I don't know if I'm just was not getting it, but the way I thought it was is that as long as you had raised this money, they would give you this lump sum. And it turned out what the incentive was actually, based off of your budget, they would give you an amount back after the product launched.
After you'd spent the money.
After you'd spent the money. And it kind of changed how you use it, because at first we believed that it was money they'd give you up front to
like
build
seed
the
money.
Product.
Yeah.
And that changes how many people you can hire and what the scope of the product is. And instead it's, okay, now once it's done, once it's launched, then we will verify, you know, run an audit and give you the amount back. We're actually getting close to that stage.
So you're close to launching this game. How soon before people can go to the year 7235 and start defend, conquer, and survive against hordes of mutant cyborgs and ruthless artificial intelligence systems?
Well, they could actually right now. We do open testing. We've been doing that for a couple of weeks now. So if anybody wanted to play the game with us.
Where do you go to help help test the game?
Our website for the game, which is tueborgame.com, TUEBOR game.com. or facebook.com/sinstudios. Either way, we do announcements all the time and give links for the download. We will be starting to distribute the game very soon, so that way we can get that incentive and we can keep building more and more and more of the product.
And finally, where will fans be able to play this Made in Michigan game?
PC is what we're going to launch on. We're just in the process of getting our Mac build finished. So PC, Mac, and Linux, it looks like. We have already gone through paperwork to be Microsoft and Sony developers, but there is still some more QA, QC stuff we have to do before we can get onto the PlayStation or the Xbox. Ideally, we'll have it on all of those platforms. It's just more of a time thing and total number of engineers. And our engineers that we've got are polishing, bug fixing, polishing, just to get it done on PC and Mac first. So first PC, Mac, Linux, after that, consoles.
You certainly parted the curtains and given us all quite a lesson in what you have to go through to launch a
it's
video
delightful.
Game.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with Tuebor. T-U-E-B-O-R, I will defend. Scott Reschke, CEO of Strength in Numbers Studios based in Lansing. Thank you so much for being with
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to Michigan Bookmark, our newest series where notable Michigan writers review the works of other Michigan writers. Seasonal Roads is the title of L.E. Kimball's impressive new book of stories. The title refers to roads that are unplowed and therefore unpassable in winter. Kimball guides you down some of these roads in Michigan's Upper Peninsula into cabins, forests, and rivers, and into the lives of three women. Author Lisa Lenzo has this review.
I fell in love with these three female characters. In the opening scene, Asa is steeling herself with alcohol in order to shoot her dead mother's sick dog. Watching Asa take aim is her daughter Jane, 10 years old and delicate seeming, but actually clear-eyed and tough. When Asa's first shot hits the dog but misses its heart, Jane tells her mother, "Shoot her again, Mom." And then there is Norna, Asa's mother and Jane's grandmother. She's perhaps the most rugged of these women. Although Norna loves the kind couple who found her in a dump as a baby and brought her home, she's tied more closely to the sun, moon, earth, and rain, which served as her first parents when she lay abandoned on the ground. This is Hemingway country, inhabited by women. Norna's cabin is on the river Hemingway reinvents as the big two-hearted in his fiction, but which Kimball and her characters call by its true name, the little two-hearted river. As the disparity in these names implies, Kimball's women are as courageous and conflicted as Hemingway's men, but the women's bravery involves less braggadocio. These women hunt, trap, and fish as skillfully as men. They cook trout and venison, rabbit and grouse. They sleep in wigwams and cabins and cheap motels. These women make love on air mattresses and on hard beds, on sand, dirt, and rocks, and they challenge and bedevil the men in their lives. In the story Deadfall, Norna ties up Sam, her Indian lover, because she suspects he has a twin and they are taking turns with her. In the collection's title story, while Asa is gathering her courage to shoot her mother's dog, she holds sips of beer in her mouth, hoping to rot her teeth and thereby aggravate her downstate dentist husband. Despite their strength and toughness, Kimball's women are vulnerable. In the story To Give Thanks, 12-year-old Asa is so upset by her mother's attempts to turn her into a hunter that she vomits. In a separate scene, Norna feels so anguished and alone that she stifles her own howls with her fists. And in The Things They Ate, the darkest and most chilling of these tales, one of Kimball's women is the fatal victim of a psychopath. But not every story in this collection is stark or serious. There is also humor and absurdity. For example, in Spinner Falls, as Asa acts out her mild yet no less sweet revenge upon her deceitful husband, I felt the same wicked smile stretching my face as when I read Margaret Atwood's stories of gender-based retribution. These 14 interlinked stories are arranged in nonlinear fashion, shifting between past, present, and future, which the President Jane sees flashes of and calls alternate realities and migrations. Rather than coming off as New Agey, Jane's visions seem to fit with the ancient and mysterious power of Michigan's northern wilderness. By the time we reach the culminating story of Seasonal Roads, and I do suggest, despite the roaming nature, that you read these stories in order, Asa has discovered that she is more similar than not to her brave daughter and her rugged mother, whom she strives to understand but never fully does. Like them, Asa realizes it is here in the north, in the UP, where she belongs. We leave this tale with Asa and her red-haired lover fishing without end, hoping to land the monster brook trout they once saw up close and almost caught. This lovely story and this inspired collection reach a conclusion that is both satisfying and uplifting, With these two hopeful humans, forever hip deep in the fiercely cold but life-giving waters of the little two-hearted river.
Lisa Lenzo is the author of two award-winning collections of short fiction. Her latest book, Strange Love, was the recipient of a Michigan Notable Book Award for 2015. Her review of Seasonal Roads by Ellie Kimball can be found at michiganradio.org. That's today's program. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.